The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all her government's policies and commitments?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Oh, kia rana, Mr. Speaker. And yes, while I know time will not allow me to list all of them, I'd like to highlight just a few, including the most significant investment we have seen in recent times into mental health, rebuilding hospitals, setting up our cancer control agency, changes to make schooling more affordable and make school buildings more modern, cleaning up our rivers, introducing the Zero Carbon Act, support provided to New Zealanders through the Families Package, which has contributed to child poverty improvements against 7 of the 9 indicators, building more public houses, banning offshore speculators, lifting the standards of rental homes, and of course our economic management, which gave us low unemployment and low government debt as a springboard to go hard, to go early and to rebuild after COVID-19.
To the Prime Minister, is it correct that her government built just 101 houses compared to the 1,000 houses originally promised by her and her then Minister of Housing, the Honourable Phil Twyford, for the first year of the flagship Kiwi Build programme?
Mr. Speaker, the most recent figures I have for Kiwi Build is that we have had 589 sold. 1,051 currently under construction. I would say, Mr. Speaker, that is 589 more affordable homes that families are living in than that last government created, and 1,000 more under construction than that last government created. Mr. Speaker, I would also add to that record that this government is currently building more houses than any government since the 1970s. Public housing places have increased by 5,103, and we currently have 3,000 public houses under construction. We stand proudly on our housing record.
Well then, is it correct that her government built just 294 houses compared to the 5,000 houses originally promised by her and her then Minister of Housing, the Honourable Phil Twyford, for the second year of the flagship Kiwi Build programme?
Mr. Speaker, I have already given the figures for Kiwi Build and the figures for the government building programme, and both of those combined, as much as the member may wish to critique our record, stands far in advance of anything that the last government did. And Mr. Speaker, these are numbers which reflect real houses, not the mythical 30,000 that apparently National built, which Mr. Speaker, would be closer to reflect the number that was sold by the last government.
So to the Prime Minister, when her government promised to build 16,000 Kiwi Build homes in the first 3 years of the Kiwi Build programme, then delivered only 452 houses at 30 June to 2020, was that a failure to deliver?
Mr. Speaker, the member may frame it, that is still more than that government did in 9 years. In 9 years. So what that member is criticising us for still far outstrips anything that her government did. In fact, Mr. Speaker, roughly 6,000 houses sold, stock reduced, left us with a crisis in housing that we are still fixing.
Well then, why under her government has the number of people waiting to go into a state house more than trebled from 5,944 in September 2017 to a whopping 17,982 as at May 2020?
Mr. Speaker, under this government, we reflect and take on board all need rather than changing the lists and cutting entire sections of the waiting list in order to engineer the numbers. And Mr. Speaker, had that last government under National built houses at the pace that we are currently, we would not have a waiting list for housing.
Is it correct that her government's $400 million progressive home ownership scheme has helped not one single person buy a home to date.
Mr. Speaker, we only recently announced the progressive home ownership scheme. Again, something that we have created and stand proudly on. Mr. Speaker, again, I would point out to the member that she's choosing to critique a record that stands far in advance of anything that the last government did. The largest government building program since the 1970s. $500 million into retrofitting state houses to make them healthy homes. A support program to sustain tenancy. Increases in the Housing First policy. Mr. Speaker, every single part of our program far outstrips and seeks to remedy a crisis we inherited.
The right Honourable Winston Peters.
And ask the Prime Minister as to whether her government has sold social housing or built them.
Mr. Speaker, as I've said, the fact that we hold the status of having built more than any government since the 1970s.
Order.
And the member is right to reflect that the last government got shed stock up to 6,000 worth of homes. We've gotten rid of, under that last government, where we have built the housing stock we so desperately need.
Yes. To the Prime Minister, is it a failure to deliver for her to promise to build a strong economy when economic growth under her government and before COVID-19 had already halved?
Mr. Speaker, I am happy to reflect on that record because pre-COVID, our GDP growth averaged 2.3%, whereas it was 2.1% under National. Unemployment was 4%, whereas it was 4.7% when we took office. And we've had the highest private sector wage growth in a decade. I stand proudly on this government's economic record, including paying down our debt, to put us into a position to weather the storm of COVID relative to what we inherited.
The Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Does the Prime Minister think that it's a success story that we will have the first family moving into a home purchased under progressive home ownership scheme in November of this year?
Mr. Speaker, yes, because as I've said, it sits alongside sustaining tenants.
No, Prime Minister, stay down. I know it's the last week, and it's sometimes a bit like school in the last week, and there's a tendency for discipline to get slack, but we're not having members shouted down when they're attempting to answer questions. The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, and that policy sits alongside Housing First, sustaining tenancies, our increase in transitional housing, and of course our significant government building program, where we added another 8,000 public houses just recently as part of our COVID response, recovery and rebuild.
Is it correct that of the $455 million allocated for mental health in Budget 2019, her government spent only around half of what was allocated for year one, and that the number of frontline mental health sites is behind her government's target?
Mr. Speaker, if the member actually read the announcements at the time, she'd recognise that we have to rebuild our mental health workforce. We scheduled at the time, Mr. Speaker, at the time we announced it, we anticipated for the 2019 and 20 year, an early $40 million worth of investment. I can report that at this point, $120 million has been distributed. We are having to train a workforce and build frontline private mental health services as we go, Mr. Speaker, but we've always known that.
Why is her government's billion trees program only planting trees at half the rate it should to reach its own target?
Mr. Speaker, we consider ourselves to be on track with the billion trees program. My memory, if it serves, is roughly 149 million trees, and of course we expect it to continue to scale up. I would point out to the House that all of these initiatives, all of the progress in environmental challenges, on climate change, on mental health and on housing are more than that government even thought about putting out or even delivering a press statement on, because they did nothing in any of those areas.
Does she stand by her commitment to provide university students with free fees when the total number of equivalent full-time domestic students in public tertiary education and training dropped by over 2,000 in 2018?
And Mr Speaker, when you have a tight labour market and jobs are plenty, that is what happens. Mr Speaker, again, we've delivered the first year free, and we have also made sure that those who will be seeking apprenticeships or vocational training in high-need areas are supported to complete that for free as well. We stand by our investment in skills.
Prime Minister, why did her government not proceed with light rail in Auckland when it promised to?
Mr Speaker, because the coalition government could not agree on a policy there. But again, there's been plenty of other transport initiatives, including plugging the $6 billion gap that Simon Bridges left for ATAP.
Is she satisfied that rapid transit solutions in Auckland have stalled over the last 3 years, while her government struggled to agree on a light rail project?
No, Mr Speaker. Interesting the member would characterise it in that way, then that's not something that her government at that time or her party has supported. But we have, of course, seen progress on the Eastern Busway, State Highway 20B, Old Mangere Bridge Replacement Project, ongoing work on the CRL, the K Road Cycleway and Constellation Bus Station, to name a few, in Auckland alone.
Is promising to build light rail from Auckland CBD to Mount Roskill and then not even starting it a failure to deliver?
No, Mr Speaker, it's actually called democracy.
Order, order. If the members want their leader to have another question, they will be quiet.
When will light rail from the Auckland CBD to Mount Roskill be completed?
Mr Speaker, I'm intrigued the member's taken an interest given she apparently doesn't support it, but thank you for joining and agreeing with us that rapid transit and public transport in Auckland is necessary. We have sent it back to the Ministry of Transport. We expect when whomever has the privilege of forming the next government that they'll be reporting directly to them with further proposals for rapid transit from the city centre to the airport.
Question number two, Dr. Deborah Russell.
Kia orana, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy in the context of the global COVID-19 pandemic?
Mr Speaker, Grant Robertson. Kia orana. On Thursday, Xero released small business employment and revenue data for June, showing many Kiwi small businesses are recovering from the impacts of COVID-19. The data showed that, compared to Australia and the United Kingdom, New Zealand has seen the strongest early rebuilding phase so far, despite having the largest drop in small business revenue when lockdowns were introduced. June 2020 small business revenue is on par with revenue in June 2019, recovering from significant drops in May and April. In Australia, revenue remains down 8% on June last year, and in the UK, it's down 18%. At the end of June, the New Zealand small business sector had 3.6% fewer jobs than pre-crisis levels. This compares to 6.8% fewer jobs in the Australian small business sector and 8.5% in the UK. Mr Speaker, while we know that many small businesses are doing it tough right now, this data underscores the benefit of the less restrictive business environment that Kiwi SMEs are now operating in, thanks to the hard work of the team of 5 million.
What reports has he seen on consumer confidence in the New Zealand economy?
Mr Speaker, on Friday, the ANZ Roy Morgan Consumer Confidence Survey for July was released, showing consumer confidence remained steady in July after resurgence through May and June. The overall consumer confidence index for July was 104.3, up from a low of 84.8 in April. It's encouraging to see a net 31% of consumers expect to be better off financially this time next year. While households' views of the next year's economic outlook lifted another 4 points, it does remain very low. The proportion of households who think it's a good time to buy a major household item did fall as well. Mr Speaker, we can see that our decision to go hard and early, both in our health and economic response to COVID-19, has given Kiwi households confidence coming out of the lockdown. But it's also clear that with the virus raging overseas and many areas reimposing restrictions, there is less certainty in the consumer environment. That's why we're committed to for supporting New Zealand firms and workers to adapt to this one in 100 year shock, and we have made significant investments to back.
What actions has the government taken to help the economy adapt to the impacts of COVID-19?
Mr Speaker, in light of your admonishments to me, I'll try to keep this short. In the face of a 1 in 100 year shock to the global economy, we have always acknowledged that we would not be able to save every job or every business, and we have not hidden the fact that this is a global economic crisis that is still going. But the government is investing to cushion the blow on households and businesses to make sure that we're in the best position to respond, recover and rebuild. Our decision to extend the wage subsidy scheme was designed to help businesses keep their employees attached while they adapt to this unprecedented economic shock. Likewise, the COVID income relief payment recognises additional assistance is needed to cushion the blow for people who are looking to work for work or taking time to retrain. As we look ahead, there are a number of areas where the government's support will continue, including investing in our people through policies to close the skills gap, creating jobs, preparing for the future, supporting small businesses and entrepreneurs, and positioning New Zealand globally to continue to trade with the world.
Question number three, the Honourable Gerry Browning.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Housing and asks, is she confident in the systems at the border Is she confident in the systems at the border and in quarantine managed isolation?
The Honourable Dr Megan Woods.
Mr Speaker, yes, I am confident. Our managed isolation and quarantine system is working well. This is demonstrated by the fact that 34,768 people have been through managed isolation since the 26th of March 2020. Since New Zealand returned to level one, all positive COVID-19 cases have been picked up in our managed isolation and quarantine facilities, and there has been no community transmission of the virus in New Zealand for more than 90 days. We're one of the few countries in the world that is successfully keeping COVID-19 out of our community. While I am confident in the systems, this doesn't mean that human error won't occur from time to time, and we've seen that play out in a handful of isolated incidents, all which have resulted in improvements to the overall MIQ systems. Finally, while I do not have direct responsibility for systems at the border, I am working closely with my colleagues to ensure all systems are working well to keep New Zealanders safe.
How does staffing of New Zealand managed isolation facilities differ from those that caused community outbreaks of COVID-19 in Victoria?
Mr Speaker, since the middle of June, since Air Commodore Webb and I assumed responsibility for the managed isolation systems, we've been going through a program of change. What we have is an operational lead at all 32 of our managed isolation facilities from the New Zealand Defence System, Defence Force. There are 4 to 6 members of NZDF on site at each of our facilities. There is 1 permanent member of the New Zealand Police Force. We also have AVSEC on site, and they are subcontracting private security firms. We also then have staffing of hotel workers that are there, and this is of course in addition to the health workforce that is on site at each of the 32 managed isolation facilities. And in regard to the staffing levels, we have been carrying out a site security assessment on all of the facilities over the last fortnight, and that is due to report back to us this week. In that report, we will be looking at a variety of factors such as resourcing, the level of services, accreditation of security firms that are providing services, as well as technology that can be deployed in the facilities.
Is there an over-reliance on private security in New Zealand managed isolation facilities?
Mr Speaker, no. Of the nine managed isolation facilities that I have visited now, that we have anywhere between 4 and 7 private security staff operating in those facilities. That is matched by between 4 and 6 NZDF personnel, as well as police personnel that are there full-time 24/7.
What steps do private security guards working in managed isolation take to ensure that they don't put their families and the wider community at risk from COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, this is an issue that we have been working through for several weeks with those workers and with their representative organisations, that we have rigorous steps in place at our managed isolation facilities to protect all workers, not just our security staff. That is the systems that are in place around the physical distancing that is required within our facilities, the safe operation from a health perspective around disease control within our facilities, and the appropriate use of PPE when it is required to protect those staff. And I think the fact that we have had 34,000 people through our managed isolation facilities and we have not had community outbreak shows New Zealanders they can feel safe, they can feel secure, that our managed isolation facilities are offering a strong line of defence and keeping them and the gains they fought for safe.
Has she heard of any instances where people who should not have been permitted to enter a managed isolation facility, such as to make a delivery to a guest, achieved entry because security guards failed to undertake appropriate vetting?
Mr. Speaker, there are a couple of instances of people trying to get into facilities as well. The reports that I have had and the briefings I have had is that the systems have worked. These people have not got past the common areas, they have not made contact, and this is a sign of the systems working. What I would like to reassure New Zealanders and not create fear for New Zealanders is that we have a robust system in place that ensures New Zealanders can be kept safe by the fact that we have a strong line of defence in our managed isolation facilities and that our systems are working in there and stopping people either entering or leaving when they should be.
What services, including food and beverage services, are provided to guests in managed isolation facilities?
Mr. Speaker, that there are three meals a day, the member might be pleased to know, three meals a day that are provided as well as morning and afternoon snacks, from my understanding. These are provided on site at the facilities, and each facility operates its own alcohol.
Both those comments are inappropriate, and both members should know better. Yeah. Mr. Browning?
Believe me.
Mr. Browning?
Yeah.
The Right Honourable Minister.
I asked the Minister as to how she would be able to cope with all the assistance that's needed if there was en masse people coming from China as advocated by the National Party.
Sorry. Mr. Speaker, that what we are.
A point of order, the Honourable Gerry Browning.
Mr. Speaker, how can you allow a question that's based on a speculative comment from the Deputy Prime Minister, with absolutely no evidence to that effect whatsoever?
Well, I think I was here in the House when I have a recollection of one of the former leaders of the National Party suggesting that a bubble be formed with Australia and shortly after that with China.
On this side of the House, this government is committed to making sure that we are operating our borders in a managed way that protects New Zealanders from COVID, but importantly also protects the gains that we collectively made as a team of 5 million. We will do this in a methodical, planned and managed way to ensure we are not putting all of that at risk.
Question number four, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. How many of the 452,425 people receiving the wage subsidy extension does he expect will become unemployed when the wage subsidy expires? And what is the government's plan if the majority of those New Zealanders lose their jobs?
Speaker, Budget 2020, the wage subsidy was extended to give businesses certainty and time to make decisions and plan for the future as the economic recovery got underway. Decisions about the 470,391 jobs currently covered by the wage subsidy extension when the scheme expires are for each individual business to make, not the government. The Treasury forecasts net employment and unemployment levels across the economy, not individual projections for various schemes. At the budget, the Treasury forecast employment to be 2.463 million in the June quarter, $2.477 million in the September quarter and $2.523 million in the December quarter. For the number of people classified as unemployed, the Treasury forecast 222,000 people in the June quarter, 268,000 people in the September quarter, and 246,000 people in the December quarter. In response to the second part of the question, I reject the premise of it, but regardless, our post-COVID economic plan focuses on five key priorities: investing in our people, creating jobs and improving productivity, preparing for the future through digital transformation, decarbonisation and research and development, supporting small businesses and entrepreneurs, and positioning New Zealand globally as a place to trade with and invest in, and hopefully, eventually, visit again. If the member likes the sound of all of that, he has the opportunity to back our recovery and rebuild by voting for that plan when the Budget 2020 legislation is debated in Parliament this evening.
A point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order.
I'm just not quite sure how a minister can reject the premise of a question when the question is if the majority... there's no premise if you're saying if the majority of those people lose their jobs. It's not a premise.
He's rejecting the possibility of that occurring. He can do it quite easily.
Supplementary. How is he so sure when he told Q&A on Sunday that the vast bulk of those Kiwis on the wage subsidy would be keeping them employed?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I've just answered, I gave the Treasury's projections for what they expect to happen. The member will be able to work out how many people are out of work at the moment based on the statistics that are released every week. And if you add that up, from the number that the Treasury projected, you'll see that the vast bulk of people who are currently on the scheme are expected to be able to stay and work.
Is he saying that he's not receiving weekly advice from Treasury as to exactly what's happening on the ground right now in terms of an extraordinary situation where hundreds of thousands of Kiwis
order,
are being
order.
Paid?
Order, come to a question, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I've heard some very long questions from other members of the House, but you haven't stopped.
All right, member will resume a seat. Question number five, Mark Patterson.
Kia rana, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Regional...
Point of order, the Honourable Gerry Browning.
Mr. Speaker, how is that decision to terminate Mr. Goldsmith's questioning even slightly reasonable, given that we've sat here and listened to exceptionally long answers today from government ministers, presumably positioning ahead of an event later next month? It seems unreasonable when there's only one more day of questioning.
Member will resume his seat. I indicated to the member that he should stop. He wasn't... His question wasn't terminated because his question was too long. It was because he argued with me afterwards on his feet without even taking a point of order. I mean, he knows that he's not allowed to do that. Mark Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Regional Economic Development, is the Provincial Growth Fund on track to meet the target of creating 10,000 jobs?
Honourable Shane Jones.
Mr. Speaker, we have outstripped the target. The Provincial Development Unit has undertaken a robust and comprehensive stocktake. 13,000 people have worked on PGF projects up and down the country. An additional 11,000 have enrolled also on skills and employment programs, many of them gone on to additional training and a host gone on to work.
Fantastic. Well done. How else can the success of the PGF be evaluated?
Speaker.
The actual applicants to the Provincial Growth Fund have reported they expect a further 15,000 people to work on projects. That gets us to 28,000 people in total. I would also say, Mr. Speaker, a key tenet of the PGF was to address low productivity outcomes and also bringing the Māori community and the ongoing problems of training, land and other resources. And an NZIER report evaluated that the Provincial Growth Fund's investment has led to an increase of GDP by $250 million per year, creation of 1,257 jobs just in those isolated provincial Māori communities.
What are some of the highlights of the PGF since it was launched in early 2018?
Speaker.
Our government believes in water storage. We know that in this post-COVID time, it's important that the productivity and the potential of land is expanded and enhanced so we can cope with droughts, floods. We've continued, sir, to invest in marine and coastal assets. Some, I must say, sir, were projects initiated in terms of the last regime, but funded by this government. We've actually gone, sir, in very difficult areas of the employee community and delivered meth addiction responses at the request of employers in our provinces. For fear, sir, of protracting the answer, it's all on the website.
Question number six, Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development. What recent announcements has she made about supporting communities in the COVID-19 recovery?
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Mr. Speaker, on Friday just gone, Minister Williams and I announced that applications were opening for our new Community Capability and Resilience Fund. This is a $36 million community fund available from the 1st of August for community groups seeking funding for initiatives that support the rebuild and recovery from COVID-19 over the next 2 years. Our community groups have done a great job at supporting New Zealanders and keeping communities safe and resilient over time as we respond and recover from COVID-19. The Community Capability and Resilience Fund will enable groups to build on this work and implement locally led solutions in their communities.
What impact have community grants had so far in the COVID-19 response?
Mr. Speaker, the Community Capability and Resilience Fund builds on the success of the Community Awareness and Preparedness Grant Fund, which was established by this government to provide immediate support to communities during the COVID-19 lockdown. This fund was exhausted, with over 900 groups supported. Communities were able to apply and receive funding quickly for innovative solutions and ideas that made an immediate positive impact for communities. We want to continue to encourage this through this new fund. Through the Community Awareness and Preparedness Fund, we supported community groups to share information, help people overcome the digital and technology challenges, provide essential goods, and check in to make sure that those isolated and living alone were supported.
Why is the Community Capability and Resilience Fund important?
Mr. Speaker, the Community Capability and Resilience Fund is for community groups who are often different to traditional providers. They are made up of a cross-section of the local community and public or population-based interest groups. The fund will have a focus on community-led initiatives such as building and improving the provision of services, developing and implementing locally determined COVID-19 recovery plans. This government is committed to supporting the well-being of our people, our whānau and communities, and this fund can help us achieve this in new and innovative ways with initiatives led by our people for our people.
Question number seven, Dr. Shane Whitty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, how does he explain recent outbound air travellers who tested positive when they arrived in Australia, and how does this relate to community surveillance testing numbers over the past 3 months?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, I'm advised that of the three recent cases that tested positive on arrival in Australia, two had been in transit through Auckland Airport and never entered the community here in New Zealand. The other positive test is believed to relate to a far earlier infection during the lockdown period, and that individual is not thought to be currently infectious. As a precaution, however, contact tracing and testing is being conducted for these cases. So far, all related tests have come back negative. In answer to the second part of the question, testing numbers have fluctuated, but I have been clear that I want to see more testing. I was encouraged to see an increase in community testing numbers over the last week and higher numbers over the weekend compared to previous weekends. I'm also pleased to report that a pop-up testing site set up today in Queenstown had so far collected 600 samples by 2 p.m. after only a few hours of operation.
Supplementary. How many contact traces have been undertaken on these recent cases?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have the numbers for those specific cases with regard to the exact number, but with regard to the first two cases I mentioned where they had transited through Auckland, CCTV footage so far has revealed that they had no close contacts while in New Zealand. They were literally here for a matter of hours and did not come into close contact with anybody. With regard to the case who tested positive after leaving New Zealand, my understanding is that the immediate household has been tested and all have come back negative, and that there were a handful of other close contacts that have been tested and have come back negative. But that contact tracing, of course, will not be closed until all of those contacts have been contacted.
Supplementary. How does he explain the following statement from ministry officials regarding the person who flew from Auckland to Sydney on July 6 and then tested positive? Quote, it appears the person may have been a previously unconfirmed case from March and this is responsible for the positive test result, unquote. And was that person then positive in New Zealand from March to July?
No, Mr. Speaker, what it's a sign of is that COVID-19, people can test positive for COVID-19 long after they have recovered from the virus. That's a well-established fact within the scientific and health community. There will be people in New Zealand who did not get tested during the lockdown, who did have COVID-19 during that time and who recovered. In some cases, people did not seek a test. They did exactly what we suggested, which was they stayed home and they got better. In other cases, they may have sought a test and not had one. Because in some cases I'm aware of people who went to get a test but were put off by the fact that there were long queues outside the testing stations. So there will be people who were positive for COVID-19 previously, who have had the virus and who have recovered, who have subsequently recovered, but who would still test positive if tested today.
Supplementary, what is the average time frame for people who have tested positive to test negative?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think that there's a specific... I don't have that information around the overall timeframe. Some people have previously tested positive and then some months later have tested negative. Others have tested positive and then some months later, after they have well and truly recovered, have tested still positive, even though they've well and truly recovered. So I don't know. I can find out if there is an average time, but I'm not sure that that would necessarily tell us much.
Supplementary. Is it correct that the first New Zealand health authorities knew about the positive July 26 Australian test was when she called the New Zealand health hotline from Australia? And what is the average time between a positive border test from a New Zealand flight arriving in Australia and notification to New Zealand authorities?
Mr. Speaker, it would depend on the notification regime of the country that the person arrives in. Some countries are faster than others at notifying New Zealand about a positive test result. And in some cases, people have contacted Healthline from overseas, and it's turned out to be that the information that they supplied to Healthline hasn't been correct. There are reports fairly regularly of some of these cases that require investigation, which are based on hearsay. So they're based on New Zealanders thinking that they know of someone who's tested positive overseas when, after it's subsequently been chased down, that is proven to not be the case.
Question number 8, Paul Eagle.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. My question is...
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
...Minister of Housing. What recent announcements has he made about improving the quality of state housing?
The Honourable
Chris Farfoy. Kia rana, Mr. Speaker. Last week at St Clair Grove in Nainai, the government announced a $500 million boost to our state house retrofit program. This will see around 1,500 older state homes and 30 towns and cities across New Zealand upgraded and renewed over the next 2.5 years. This shows our government following through on our commitment to not only add thousands of homes to the public housing stock, but also improve the quality of public housing available to New Zealanders and their whānau.
Good work, Minister.
Supplementary. What will the retrofit program mean for tenants?
Mr. Speaker, tenants will be living in warmer, drier and healthier homes. Their homes will be improved by the installation of wall, ceiling and floor insulation, double glazing of windows, improvements to ventilation and air tightness, new heating and making these homes more accessible. I'm advised that tenants who live in homes that were part of a pilot are already enjoying the health benefits of homes that have already been retrofitted. For example, we've heard from one tenant in the Hutt Valley whose son had a respiratory condition which has improved since moving back into the retrofitted home, and this means fewer visits to their doctor and more days at school.
Supplementary. How will the retrofit program support regional economies?
Mr. Speaker, as well as being a significant investment in the health of New Zealand's public housing supply, this $500 million is also a major investment in the regional economies where this retrofitting work will happen. Kāinga Ora will look to use contractors of all sizes to carry out this work, creating more opportunities for a range of companies in the regions. Many of these companies will be experiencing the economic effects of COVID-19, and the government recognises how important programs like this are to give local contractors certainty over their project pipeline.
Question number nine, the Honourable Todd McClay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Tourism, why was AJ Hackett given a $5.1 million grant by the government, but outbound tourism operators such as travel agents were given no support in the recently announced $311 million COVID aid package?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Mr. Speaker, AJ Hackett and over 120 other tourism businesses all meet the strategic asset criteria. They applied and were approved to receive financial support. No outbound operators like travel agents applied to the strategic asset fund. That is why no support was given.
To the Minister, is he aware that travel agents continue to assist clients with refunds without remuneration? And if so, do you think the government should support them as they have AJ Hackett?
Well, Mr. Speaker, first of all, they received the wage subsidy scheme, but I've heard varying levels of support that the outbound tourism operators want. First of all, it was $1 billion that they wanted support from the government. Then it was $180 million. Then it was $30 million. Look, if they need support from the government, then they need to come to us with a coherent package of the support that they need, just not plucking figures out of the air.
Has he requested any information on the number of jobs that would be lost in the outbound tourism sector when the wage subsidy ends, compared to the 20 jobs saved at AJ Hackett by his government's $5.1 million grant?
Mr. Speaker, specifically to that question, no, I haven't asked about job losses in the outbound tourism organisation, but I know that the $400 million package that we've announced, 16 times bigger than the $25 million package a year that the opposition are offering the tourism industry, will save 3,000 jobs directly, 7,000 jobs indirectly, and with the positive spillover effect, 7,000 jobs if all of those businesses were post-COVID are able to ramp up, and then the positive spillover effects into businesses around them will mean thousands more jobs will be saved because of the wonderful $400 million package that this government has put together for the tourism industry.
You know, Turicats, eh?
Supplementary to the Minister, what reports has he seen in response to the support given to AJ Hackett?
Well, Mr. Speaker, Queenstown Lakes Mayor Jim Bolt said the money would benefit the whole of Queenstown. Quote, it is one of those businesses that is Queenstown, and if somebody out of town was conjuring up a vision of Queenstown, AJ Hackett Bungie would certainly be there alongside other businesses. He said restaurants, bars, hotels and other operators all gained from Bungie surviving.
What further announcements has he made regarding the tourism recovery package?
Mr. Speaker, the tourism recovery package I announced on Saturday includes over $230 million in grants and loans for 126 strategic tourism businesses that could help protect the jobs of around 3,000 people directly employed in the industry, $50 million for a regional events fund, $20 million for inbound tour operator loan scheme, and $10 million to lift digital capability in the sector.
Similarities does the criteria used for assessing the AJ Hackett grant have to the criteria used to grant funding to THL and Waitomo sooner than small tourism operators such as Waitomo Adventures, Footwhistle Glowworm Caves and local travel agents?
Well, Mr. Speaker, we moved quickly to support strategic tourism businesses that needed urgent help. At the time these decisions were made, the Strategic Tourism Assets Protection Program was going to follow a similar path and process. However, the economic conditions and realities changed, and we had to adapt the support we're providing other businesses. This was the only way we were able to support a broad range of tourism businesses in a sustainable way that made sense. The Tourism Minister's Recovery Group has a mandate that it can decide on urgent investments which are outside the application round, and it has done so on these occasions.
Is the Minister aware that the outbound tourism operators support thousands and thousands of jobs around the country which are now at risk without direct government support? And why has he prioritised businesses like AJ Hackett and those 20 workers over travel agents?
Well, Mr Speaker, I'm not sure that the member understands that outbound tourism operators are trying to lure New Zealanders out of New Zealand into overseas markets, when our job is to lure overseas people into New Zealand to support our tourism industry. The fact though, of the matter, though, is that the borders are closed and there is no inbound or outbound tourism happening at the moment.
Supplementary. The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Mr Heard reports that the $500,000 granted to Napier's Art Deco Trust over 2 years will save their iconic festival, which was probably going to have to be cancelled without this announcement, will save lots of jobs and contribute greatly to Napier's economic recovery.
Order, member may answer any two of those four questions.
Mr Speaker, we've heard reports from all around the country from the tourism industry about what wonderful support the STAP program has been. As we've said, 3,000 jobs directly, 7,000 jobs will be saved if those businesses can amp up, as well as the positive spillover effects into other businesses around because of the STAP and the whole tourism package, Mr Speaker. And I have to remind everybody, our $400 million we've invested this year is 16 times bigger than the package that the opposition were offering to the tourism industry.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Can I ask the Minister, in respect of tourism ventures, in the criterion, is there the judgment which runs something like this is not likely to create an envy factor when looked at in the big picture?
Mr Speaker, our criteria were well thought out, and as I said, the tourism operators, the 126 that got it, met the criteria, unlike the outbound tourism operators who didn't even apply, so they couldn't meet the criteria with no application.
Does the Minister think it's good enough that he's saying to the thousands and thousands of people that work for tourism businesses, travel agents around the country who are about to lose their jobs, that it's their fault that nobody applied, and he hasn't even bothered to ask how many would lose their jobs or sought to meet with them?
Order, order. The other questions the member answered, asked had some relevance to the responsibilities of the Minister of Tourism. The Minister of Tourism is not responsible for outbound operators.
Question number 10, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse. Me.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Regional Economic Development. Does he stand by his statement that the Provincial Growth Fund will, quote, create sustainable jobs in the regions, end quote, and how many new permanent roles have been created that did not exist prior to the Provincial Growth Fund being allocated to those projects?
The Honourable Shane Jones.
Yes, Mr Speaker, and I would point out to the House we've always included part-time, full-time and contractors in our jobs data collection because it reflects the number of people who have come into the labour work, especially in those sectors that rely on contractors. A job is a job. However, on the question of the number of permanent new roles, until such time the full impact and rollout of the fund is completed, it's not possible to answer that question.
Well, how therefore could can his press release this morning say that the number of jobs created by the PGF outstripped the 10,000 target? Well, the questions asked by the PDU didn't actually include a question on how many jobs were created.
Speaker. The member is slightly incorrect there. The compilation of the data was carried out by officials who got in contact by both phone call and email in terms of how many people had been employed at various points in the journey on different projects, The difficulty, Mr. Speaker, with the full accounting of jobs lies in the fact that a number of the projects have yet to kick off, such as the breakwaters at the mouth of the Whanganui River, or indeed the iconic port, wharf and harbour development at Opotiki.
Given that answer and the answer to his primary question, how could he so boldly say that 13,217 jobs had been created by the PGF?
Speaker, that is a well-proportioned figure. It reflects, sir, an exercise undertaken, and COVID has had such an impact on the operations of this area of government. And as a consequence of the officials being asked to go back and re-engage, it's actually given me the confidence to say that the figure will actually be 28,000 as the projects roll out. Mr. Speaker, I need to repeat again, a sum of $700 million has actually been handed out in the form of Pūtea cash into the accounts, into the pockets of the employees, and I would invite the member to divide 13,000 into 700 million.
To the Minister. Does he think, quote, sustainable growth, end quote, has been achieved when 6,648 of the 13,000 jobs no longer exist after just 2.5 years?
Therein lies a problem in the member's logic. This fund has invested in infrastructure. As infrastructure is completed, tertiary and secondary investors with their own money follow up. Whether it's an improvement to rail, whether it's an improvement in maritime infrastructure, whether it's improvement in water storage, many jobs will flow, but you don't employ permanently people after an infrastructure project has been completed. Then you allow the genius of the market to come to play.
Honourable Simon Bridges.
Is he aware of a putative provincial growth fund project, University of Waikato Marine Centre in Tauranga, that the Minister of Conservation has just declined despite its clear purpose of environmental research, and does he know why?
Mr. Speaker, a matter of that detail requires a very serious answer, and I invite, sir, the member to put that in writing. I am not aware that the outcomes that are contained in our coalition agreement to do with aquaculture are being frustrated at all.
Minister, is the reason he didn't announce the result of the question by the PDU on how many jobs were saved when they otherwise might have been lost is because the answer was not many, if any?
I shall endeavour to address that riddle. I repeat again, sir, the allocation of $700 million has given us a figure of 13,000 workers being engaged in the delivery of projects to date. Now, the jobs, sir, will most certainly flow when the initiatives are fully rolled out, and that's why we take a great deal of diligence as we move forward in the allocation of the remainder of the fund.
Question number 11, Willow Jean Prime.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Health. How is the government supporting Māori health and wellbeing?
Mr. Speaker. Honourable Penny Hanara.
Mr. Speaker, last week I was pleased to announce Whakamaua, the government's Māori health action plan. Mr. Speaker, this plan sets out the pathway towards achieving greater health equity for Māori over the next 5 years and demonstrates the government's commitment to improving Māori health and wellbeing.
Supplementary, what specific outcomes is Whakamaua seeking to achieve?
Mr. Speaker, Whakamaua has four high-level outcomes. Firstly, that iwi, hapū, whānau and Māori communities are exercising their authority to improve their health and wellbeing. Second, ensuring the health and disability system is fair and sustainable and delivers more equitable outcomes for Māori. Thirdly, Mr. Speaker, it seeks to address racism and discrimination in all its forms within our health system. Lastly, sir, the plan protects mātauranga Māori throughout the health and disability system.
Supplementary. Why do we need a Māori Health Action Plan?
Mr. Speaker, we know the health and disability system is failing Māori, and as a result, there are significant inequities between Māori and tauiwi. Whakamaua provides clear direction on how we can fix that. Many of the actions listed within the plan will help counter the influence of implicit bias and systemic racism in the system. I'm pleased to say that some of these actions have already begun, including streamlining patient pathways for whānau Māori, providing virtual consults and a more inclusive approach to telehealth.
Question number 12, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. What are some of her government's policy achievements?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister. Order, order.
Mr. Speaker, thank you for the use of the word some. I wouldn't want to wish to keep the House longer than I am able. Mr. Speaker, we've rolled out Mana Ake, a mental health support program for kids in school in Canterbury and Kaikoura, extended school-based health services, reduced the cost of going to the doctor for more than 500,000 New Zealanders, set up our Cancer Control Agency and the Suicide Prevention Office, boosted funding for Pharmac, replacing 12 radiation machines to take the pressure off DHBs. We're rebuilding our health workforce with 1,400 more nurses, 580 more doctors, 530 more allied health workers, addressing major infrastructure issues at Auckland City Hospital, Green Lane, Middle Moor, obviously Dunedin, just to name a few. Mr. Speaker, I have a long list. I've just started on health. I'm not sure if you'll oblige me to allow to continue with housing, education, and a range of others. But Mr. Speaker, perhaps I'll leave it to the members supplementary.
Order. I'm going to remind people in the galleries that they're not allowed to get involved in this question period, and as someone who knows the consequences of becoming involved from the galleries, I strongly recommend that people in the galleries don't.
Supplementary. Why did the Prime Minister perhaps forget to mention Kiwi Build, the public house waiting list, Auckland Light Rail, material hardship
order
for children?
Order, the members answer two supplementaries.
That's it. Mr. Speaker, because the primary didn't allow me to get past the first part of health, let alone get into transport, housing and a number of other areas where I am very proud of our record, Mr. Speaker.
Why didn't the Prime Minister mention that after her intervention at Ihu Matau, there are more houses cancelled that would have been built there than Kiwi Build managed to build in 3 years?
I actually reject the premise of that question, but if the member would like to give me another platform to talk about this government's record of building more houses than any other government since the 1970s, of retrofitting our state houses to give them another 50 years of life through $50 billion. Please sit down, I'm not finished.
Order. I'm anticipating a point of order, and I think the Prime Minister has come... has gone beyond what was asked of her.
Supplementary.
David Seymour.
Why did the Prime Minister perhaps forget to mention that her government inherited a $6 billion surplus for 2020 and turned it into a $1 billion deficit even before the COVID crisis hit?
Point of order, the Right Honourable.
You're surely very close to the end of this session. We'll realise that there is a rule where you cannot ask the government member a patchy question and enabling that member to attack the opposition.
I think the member has a history of not being helpful with this point of order, which he's... The one point that I'll give him is his consistency through this parliament. David Seymour, ask it again.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So the Prime Minister, why did she perhaps forget to mention that her government inherited a forecast $6 billion surplus for 2020, but by the end of last year, Treasury forecast a $1 billion deficit for this year, even before COVID hit?
Mr. Speaker, because I only got to health. Let's do the economy. I'm happy, of course, Mr. Speaker, to stand on our record of delivering GDP growth close to an average of 2.3%, which was higher than the 2.1% of the last government. We delivered $13 billion worth of surpluses and got our net debt relative to GDP under 20%. Were it not for that positioning, Mr. Speaker, we would be in a much worse position going into COVID-19. As it stands, relative to many other OECD nations, our debt will be lower even after our spending on things like the wage subsidy because of the preliminary work we did and the position we put us in.
Up for venture.
The Prime Minister forget to mention there are over 2,250 more police have graduated out into our communities than when we came into government.
No. I've had enough of those patches.
Why did the Prime Minister perhaps forget to mention her government's total failure to make any tangible progress on the highly confused Dominion Road Light Rail project, which runs right along the border of her electorate?
Mr. Speaker, because I didn't get to transport, where I'm happy, of course, to report that over 2,000 kilometres of safety improvements have been made. The $6 billion needed for ATAP to make sure that we're delivering a range of modes for Aucklanders and reduce congestion. And, Mr. Speaker, when it comes to the issue of light rail, which I don't believe either that member supported, but seems very interested in it now, yes, we didn't get agreement across parties, but that has not stopped other progress in the area of transport.
No.
Why is it so...
Order. The member's had four supplementaries already. The Honourable David Parker.
A point of order, David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, can I just clarify, are you counting my repeat of a question after...
Absolutely.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
In that case, I apologise to the member. It just feels like a lot.
Well, Mr. Speaker, people might have to get used to it. Mr. Speaker...
Order. All members will settle down. I think all of us know that in the next 3 months is going to be a bit of a turnover and we won't be focusing too much on it. David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, why is it so difficult just to answer a question and accept that some of the things the Prime
Order,
Minister promised, failed.
Member will resume his seat. He knows that's not a question. The Honourable David Parker.
Can the Prime Minister confirm the recent endorsement by David Seymour of the proposed repeal and replacement of the Resource Management Act, including Mr. Seymour's kind acceptance that this is more than the prior government achieved over the prior 9 years?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, I expect that was the supplementary the member was going to ask, given that he's given me so many opportunities this question time.
A point of order, David Seymour.
I seek leave to ask an additional supplementary question at the expense of the Labor Party.
Order. I hear some objection. I think it's fair to say that I will put it to the House, but I think it's fair to say that not long after the member completed it, I got an vindication from a sparring partner that he wouldn't get permission. Is there any objection?
Yes.
There appears to be objection. That concludes oral questions.